I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, talking about a book of our times and our place, it turns out. David Foster Wallace's 1,000-page cement block of a novel, Infinite Jest. It's the rising generation's epic, as many testify. We got 200 and some contributions for this radio conversation posted on Reddit so far. IJ, as they say, is about addiction, entertainment, compulsive consumption, emotional isolation, television, the internet, anxiety, panic attacks, and loneliness throughout. One of the Reddit writers said, "Infinite Jest, it's still where I go to understand the queer sadnesses of 21st century life." Here is our own sampling of Vox Pop from listeners like you.
David Foster Wallace's incredible, grammatically correct run-on sentences can deliver an emotional wallop that I can't think of any other writer really achieving before or since.
The thing about Infinite Jest for me is that I'm from Boston, and it's one of the places I derive my civic pride from. The familiar setting of Infinite Jest is so great.
When I look at the motley crew of people that make up Infinite Jest, I believe that we're all pieces of these different characters at different points in our lives, or even different points in our day. I don't believe there's a single person who can read the book and not see themselves in it.
I think that Infinite Jest is important because it captures our inability to grasp all the information thrown at us from the internet, television, and all the media sources, and our own existential struggles.
I read Infinite Jest this last summer after I graduated from college. It was sitting on my bookshelf like kind of a status symbol, and people would always ask me about it, and I'd be like, oh, I got partway through it.
Even all these years after the first time I read the book, the most important and crucial idea still sticks out in my mind, which is how to be a person in American society today who unabashedly and earnestly cares about something.
I've read Infinite Jest twice, and I love it. I consider it the Appalachian Trail of literature, and it's well worth the hike.
Ultimately, we're still talking about Wallace and Infinite Jest 19 years after its publication. I'd be surprised if the conversation stopped anytime soon.
We're talking about Infinite Jest this hour as A, Boston, hidden in plain sight, B, as literature, and C, with Deb Larson, who became a character in the book and still works in Wallace's own recovery station. We're talking about the ordeal, the redemptive ordeal of rehab, his and hers. Infinite Jest is not your picture book, Boston. David Foster Wallace came to town from Amherst College and before that from the University of Illinois campus where he'd grown up, sort of a faculty brat. When he sat down to novelize what he'd seen and learned in his Boston years, he didn't remember the Freedom Trail and Faneuil Hall. He remembered addicts and all sorts of people like himself in struggle with crushing habits. And he left all of us, I think, with ways to look and see ourselves anew and to notice some of the people we've missed. We took the Wallace tour, sampling the favorite drinking and drugging depots, blackout sites, dry-out treatment centers, including McLean Hospital in Belmont, AA meeting sites with Boston accents and Boston attitudes, and Wallace's own halfway house for alcoholics. Our guest in the studio was our guide on the street the other day, Bill Latanzi, playwright and poet. He's one of five professors we know who have taught Infinite Jest as a course, and still do, at places like Harvard, Tufts, Boston University. Here are some highlights, starting with the party house outside Inman Square to the halfway hell in Brighton.
If there were to be a plaque put anywhere for up Wallace in the Boston area, I think it would be here. This is 35 Houghton Street, in just outside Inman Square, or on the Somerville side. And he lived here for 6 short months with his best friend, the lawyer and novelist Mark Costello. And this was where they had a very wild time. Prior, he came in April of 89. He stayed here until his breakdown around Halloween of 89. And they spent the summer. Mark was working as a lawyer. David was mostly drinking, smoking pot, going out to bars at night, and writing ferociously, obsessively, manically, 10, 20,000 words a day. And Costello summed it up by saying, quote, "There was no shortage of chaos around 35 Houghton Street, apartment 2. Lost bills went unpaid. The phone rang at 3 a.m., and women banged on the back door 2 hours later." We're heading out through BU now into Alston on our way to Brighton and the fictional Enfield. if you're a Wallace nut, if you've read the book, you start to get excited around here because we're approaching Granada House, which is the Ennett House in the book. So these buildings are still numbered. The numbering seems to be the same as in the book. This is the Addiction Treatment Center of New England. This is one of the catatonics live there, and it leads to a digressive conversation that Hal has with the cops down at the bar, which is called The Unexamined Life, which I love. And the cops refer to the catatonics as he writes, objet d'arts. They call it the shed, because they don't live there so much as are stored there. This is the actual place, this in 1989-90, when Wallace was here from about the 1st of December 1989 to about the 1st of June or July 1990. At that time it was called Granada House. He turned it in the book into Ennett House, and this is where he lived with a roommate called Big Craig, who was thought to be the basis of Don Gately, the hero of the book, one of the other heroes of the book. And he describes it this way. One of Ennett House's live-in staffers' rotating PM jobs is just to be awake and on call in the front office all night for dream duty. People in early recovery from substances often get hit with real horror show dreams or else traumatically seductive substance dreams, and sometimes trite but important epiphanic dreams. And the staffer on dream duty is required to be up doing paperwork or sit-ups or staring out the broad bay window in the front office downstairs, ready to make coffee and listen to the residents' dreams and offer the odd, practical, upbeat Boston AA type insight into the possible implications for the dreamer's progress in recovery.
Don't you love that dream duty? You can hear lots more of that tour on our website, radioopensource.org. Bill DeTunzi, that tour changed my sense of the book, We Owe You. And I don't think it's just local pride or sort of Boston provincialism that kind of expands in that whole process, the sort of Stations of the Cross of David Foster Wallace. I took it as a way to see a city and a lesson in seeing invisible people.
It's a whole different Boston that he's imagined, that I think hovers, that Wallace has imagined, that hovers just 6 inches above the real one. And the book is, I'm fascinated by how Wallace took his personal experience and transmuted it into this imagined world, this imagined Boston that sits right on top of the real one. So, yeah, it's a little bit like going to see ghosts, and some of them are real people that I don't know. I only know the characters he made out of them in the book.
You say he imagined, but we know he lived this life. How do we save it from being designated as, or redesignated as, memoir?
Oh, gosh. I mean, just read the thing. First of all, while the addiction story is central to the book, it's important in the book. It's also only a third of the main story. There's a whole second entirely fictional plot about a fictional tennis academy that's on top of a hill in Brighton. There's this whole kind of thriller plot about the deadly film Infinite Jest that the terrorists are trying to get in the United States. Office of Unspecified Services are racing for.
To mention the amalgamation of Mexico, Canada, and the U.S., which...
Yeah, and it's set in a slight future time in which the years are subsidized because we don't have enough tax money to pay for anything, so corporations pay for the years. So you have the year of the Depend Adult Undergarment, for example.
Yeah, but distinguish it from memoir in the guts of it, which is his recovery story.
Well,
or is that
I think that it's not any different than an F. Scott Fitzgerald novel or any other novel you could name. It's definitely grounded in his personal experience, but it gets split into so many different characters. So there's a little bit of Wallace in the guy who quits smoking pot 70 times and has to change friends every time he quits because he's told them so. There's part of Wallace in the advertising guy who argues logically that AA makes no sense, and yet continues to do it and continues to find it helpful. So I think that's a kind of straightforward novelist move to take your experience and transform it into something.
There's a fundamental premise here that I want you to explain. I sense, even on the trip, but reading the book, there's an implication somewhere here that the surroundings are inseparable from the sickness of the people inside them. In other words, that the illness is not in the character or the characters. It's somehow cultural or social.
Sure. There's this passage in the book, this Enfield Tennis Academy is a strange place where the kids are great athletes, but they're also great intellectuals. And there's a class that's taught there called the personal is the political is the psychopathological, which the first and second time I read it, I thought that's hilarious. You know, what a funny joke on academia. And then the more I thought about it in the book and read more, I think he's quite serious that for Wallace, yes, these people have individual addictions, individual illnesses. He certainly had his. But he did begin to connect it up with problems in the culture that he looked at as connected with consumerism and entertainment, and that we're all trying to escape ourselves, escape loneliness, escape facing the hardships of life and looking for an easy way out. And so whether that's losing yourself in tennis, losing yourself in drugs, losing mm-hmm. yourself in alcohol or television, it's the same problem. And it's the culture that's pushing us that way.
It's certainly a dimension that takes it way beyond memoir.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. I'm. It's I mean, the thing is so intricately constructed, and his beating heart is at the center of it, but the creation that he made from it is so much greater and different from his personal experience. I don't think you could call it a memoir.
It's extraordinary. I mean, one last note about the building we saw, the real bricks and the details which you described in the book, those various units of the recovery station, one for Vietnam vets for certain very delayed stress disorders, one for Alzheimer's patients with VA pensions, one for catatonics, the several units described as seven moons orbiting a dead planet. Mm. We're getting a map of David Foster Wallace's mind. A map as big as the landscape this hour. It reminds you of the Borges story about the map that was precisely as big and detailed as the territory being mapped. We're talking about David Foster Wallace's novel of addiction, Infinite Jest. The question is, does a book's staying power among 20-something readers make it a classic? Sven Burkitz is an essayist and critic who got to know and like and critique David Foster Wallace when he was getting started in the late 1980s. I met Sven Burkitz yesterday in his Boston University office where he edits the quarterly Agni. I asked him if he's ready to call Infinite Jest a great book.
I think it's a book with a huge amount of great writing and great influence. And the only place one might hold back on that greatness question is whether it realizes itself formally. And one of the big arguments by the critics has always been that, well, he launches these three massive, intricate lines and at the end, in a sense, doesn't bring them together. He himself was not a fan or proponent of closure, so it becomes one of those strange aesthetic debates. But I would say on the basis of the prose and on the influence of the prose and the influence of Wallace on several generations of writers that are now trailing after and manifesting things that he opened up, I'd say it's got to be the most influential book of his generation, if not the greatest.
Put it simply, on a Moby Dick scale, on a Huck Finn scale, where is it?
Well, if those are tens, then it would be our contemporary eight in an era when there's not much that would be a 10 anyway. I think it is of the ilk of Moby Dick, because what it sets out to do is not to tell a story, but in a sense almost to create a literary environment, a kind of culture, and I think it succeeds very much at doing that. It's a product of complete compulsion and obsession, and I think it is a realization of obsession, and I think that's part of the reason it has such a tremendous kind of suction pull on people. Mm-hmm. I think even people who don't fully finish it or dabble in it, but they also recognize the power of that. And so other names you could throw out, again, we're not measuring, for the ages, but, you know, there's a Dostoevskian kind of intensity in places and a Kafkaesque obsessiveness. And those are all qualities that are streaming through that book. He's a badge people wear. They like to wear it for a host of reasons. there is the, you know, tragic conflagration of the hugely gifted person who crashed in his life. He was a wonderful channel for obsessive anxiety, which you could say is part of the temper of our times. And if anyone caught it for his generation and the ones on either side, it was probably Wallace.
Sundberger, tell us your David Foster Wallace story. It's long and interesting.
Yeah, and it goes back a ways. Something he and I shared and were fascinated by, and it very much had to do with a kind of sense that he really got the way in which media, entertainment, and computers had, in a very short space, transformed everything. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a lot of what he was bringing to the novel. He had such a strange, antic, comic take on things like Jeopardy and Dave Letterman. He was obsessed with the media and the ironization of American culture, and that seemed to filter into a lot of what he was, on the one hand, writing very, you know, serious contemporary fiction. On the other hand, he was obsessed with playing with ironic inflection and doing it very intelligently. And then he had that essay called E Unibus Plurum, which was about television and how television had completely changed the literary landscape. And I know that he and I wrote back and forth a little bit about that.
Those are two very important themes. One thing, the whole arc in his life and his interest in irony and sort of getting over it, bathing in it, just, you know, being immersed in an ironic culture, and then saying, no, we gotta get someplace else. We gotta get back to life.
Well, yeah, and he had a wonderful phrase for that. He thought we had reached a terminal place with kind of double entendre, and he wanted to get back to single entendre values. But how to do that once you'd gone as far along as we all had culturally down the pathways of irony and self-reflectiveness. So I think he was battling that all along.
But isn't part of the moral of the whole story that you have to go through recovery? You have to go with suffering people to get back to human basics.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think there are two, one is the aspect that played in his life, which I can't testify to because I didn't know him that well. But I think he found in recovery and in the sort of culture at the bottom kind of a wonderful place to begin to locate a way out from endless cleverness.
We're all fascinated and impressed in a way by the fact that this novel has been adopted by a generation, and so many people will testify to the meaning of it in their lives. At the same time, I think, holy mackerel, that's a grim, gruesome account of a time. It's all about suffering people in a rich country, addicted people, troubled in every way, a lot of them suicidal, as he in the end was. I mean, what does that tell you? It's a kind of warning, isn't it? That this is the novel of the last 20 years and maybe for the next 50 years.
Yeah. It's tricky, and I often wonder what it is that people are attaching themselves to when they attach themselves to that book. And I'm not always sure that it is what you're saying, though that's so definitely kind of the core content of it. But I think there's a way in which he combines various qualities. He makes kind of a high level of almost nerdish intelligence palatable and kind of hip, and he does it through a stance, a kind of jargon, a self-deprecatory thing where he can deprecate his intelligence even as he's manifesting it. I keep coming back to this notion that it's this particular collision of many strains of opposites that Wallace somehow pulls together. You know, high-mindedness and the tragic and the hugely comic, but also, as you were just saying, I mean, the vision of what he's looking at, so much of it is bleak and without horizon. And it's this voice. I mean, we haven't used the word voice here, but if you just start open the book and start reading any one of his riffs, and you get lost in the voice, and it is just, you know, this astonishing sort of downhill tumble, but under high control. And so, yeah, I think in a way he's a whole generation saying, yeah, we are kind of crazy, but we're also really smart. And we're smart in really strange ways that you may not know about. And David Foster Wallace is our man.
That was Sven Burkitz of Boston University and the quarterly Agni. Bill Lattanzi, have you said how seriously you take Infinite Jest as literature on the Moby Dick scale?
I'm in a much better situation because I'm not a professional literary critic, so I can say yeah. I remind you, Moby Dick got terrible reviews when it came out, so it takes a while to see where these things fall. Yeah, to me, it's absolutely brilliant. To me, people like Harold Bloom, who say he doesn't know how to write, don't understand that he's playing a different game. Even he's playing a post or post-postmodern game, that he deliberately doesn't wrap up these three strands at the end. He wants you to have to put it together. He wants the interaction and the reader doing the work. And, you know, I'm with Machiko Kakutani of the Times, who said he can do anything and he can do it all at once.
Wow. I mean, I have to stand with Harold Bloom as a matter of principle with respect to Michiko Kakutani. And Harold Bloom went further than that. Not that I agree with him on this particular point, but I have to acknowledge him as my master. He said Stephen King is Cervantes compared with David Foster Wallace. We have no standards left. David Foster Wallace seems to have been a very sincere and troubled person, said Harold Bloom, but that doesn't mean I have to endure reading him. I even resented the use of the term from Shakespeare when Hamlet calls the king's jester Yorick a fellow of infinite jest. He said there's no discernible talent here.
There's a great phrase I learned from Junot Diaz, which is, your mileage may vary.
Either way, I want to hear you read one of those juicy Wallace passages that you read so well.
Sure. Well, I brought along a passage from a radio show that's in the book, so I thought that would be appropriate. It's this character, Madame Psychosis, also known as Joelle Van Dyne, also based, we think, why not, on Mary Carr, who was heavily involved in David's life at this time. He was quite head over heels in love with her. And this is just before her program, 60 Minutes More or Less with Madame Psychosis, goes on the air on the MIT radio station called WHYY, the largest whole prime on the FM dial. Madame Psychosis is smoking again, listening, head cocked. Her tall screen will leak smoke for her show's whole hour. The student engineer is counting down from 5 on an outstretched hand. He can't see how she sees. And as pinky meets palm, she says what she said for 3 years of midnights, an opening bit that Mario Incandenza, the least cynical person in the history of Enfield Ma, across the river, listening faithfully, finds, for all its black cynicism, terribly compelling. Her silhouette leans and says, and lo, for the earth was empty of form and void, and darkness was all over the face of the deep. And we said, look at that effort dance. Mm. Had to change the one word there.
What about this incredible, endless cleverness in a guy who also was upset that people didn't understand at the end that he was driving at a mood of sadness?
Yeah, I think it was frustrating for him. And I think, too, that that's part of what accounts for the appeal, not just to a generation, not just to people in their 20s. I mean, I'm teaching now at a Cambridge Adult Ed, and I've got people 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s all responding to the book. And I think it's because of the situation Sven's describing that we all feel ourselves in, that we all feel caught up in a jaded, cynical world where we can't believe anything and we're looking for something to believe in, but it's so hard to find. We can't go back to the way it was with Oliver Twist and the Christmas Carol and these kinds of things. We don't believe that anymore, but we want to believe something. And in Infinite Jest, you see that struggle. You see all the characters struggling to find faith, struggling to find something to sustain them in life. And finding it, losing it, finding it, losing it, finding it, losing it, like we all do.
But I'm still puzzled. What should we conclude? I think novelists are the great interpreters of the world in front of us. But we don't take these readings down as a kind of political fact or a very concrete warning that there's something desperately empty in our social, cultural, emotional worlds these days. Yeah. I mean, if we took it seriously, we'd do something about it.
You'd think so. Well, I mean, Wallace, there's a writer who says that the thing about Wallace was he didn't look away. He looked, he kept looking.
Exactly.
So I can point to the article about St. Albans, Vermont, which is a massive heroin addiction problem. I can point to the Nielsen rating. The last yearly estimate is that American families watch 5.1 hours of television a day. 49% of kids 9 years old would rather spend time watching television than with their fathers. I mean, that's a devastating statistic, right?
This should be in the State of the Union speech. This is the State of the Union.
Then you'd have to really look, and you'd have to really change things, right? And we're not there. We can't raise taxes. We can't get anything done. We're going to be subsidizing a year soon. I mean, it feels quite prescient, this novel.
Well, you know, somebody put this in the Reddit thread on this whole question that we asked people to join in on, and we had asked, is this the novelist of our generation or your generation? And somebody wrote, if so, what does it say about the generation?
Yeah.
This generation is in trouble. And there's a panic attack.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I don't think we're saying anything that hasn't been said on a lot of other programs in a lot of other places.
No. It's all unique here, Bill. It's never been said before.
But, I mean, in terms of the culture and the problems with the culture and... And I think it's because it's a universal human thing that is in the culture that makes it great literature. It's not just the eccentric story of an obsessed brilliant guy.
I love it, but I'm holding out too. I mean, as long as I can remember, people in my generation were conspicuous carrying Ayn Rand's Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged.
Oh dear.
Close to their hearts down the street. And that established that she had a grip on a generation or on lots of people, but it never was said that it made her a great novelist.
True, yeah. Well, I think it goes back to this modern, postmodern thing. I mean, what do we mean by great novelist? If we mean by great novelist, is it as tidy as George Eliot? No, but that's not the game he's playing. And you can say, and then
is
the
it
argument
as compelling
becomes,
as it is real as American Pastoral by Philip Roth? I mean, that's a fair question, I think.
Yeah, it's a hell of a book. I mean, again, it is for me. And I often say, this is one of my favorite books I've ever read in my life. I don't recommend it to anyone because of the hurdle that your call-in person said. It is like hiking the Appalachian Trail. And you do have to have an appetite for this style. Philip Roth's not to everyone's taste either, even though he's undeniably great.
Would you read perhaps another sample of this writer at his best, Bill?
Let's see.
Bill Lattanzi, who, if you ask him very politely, might take you on the David Foster Wallace tour around Boston.
All right. I'm going to read a thing that it's a little long, so you stop me.
Okay.
And it's a... This is about tennis. This is a German professor, and it brings, and I think this is part of the problem, maybe, for people of Harold Bloom's generation. It's funny, it's cartoonish, it's pushed, it's satirical. He's talking about philosophy, he's mixing high and low, and it winds up with a joke that could be from the Three Stooges, okay? And
okay.
So for some people, that just immediately disqualifies it from being great literature. For others, not. Schtitt was educated in pre-unification gymnasium under the rather Kanto-Hegelian idea that junior athletics was basically just training for citizenship. That junior athletics was about learning to sacrifice the hot, narrow imperatives of the self, the needs, desires, the fears, the multiform cravings of the individual appetitive will, to the larger imperatives of a team, okay, the state, and a set of delimiting rules, okay, the law. It sounds almost frighteningly simple-minded, though not to Mario, across the redwood table listening. By learning in Palestra the virtues that pay off directly in competitive games, the well-disciplined boy begins assembling the more abstract, gratification-delaying skills necessary for being a team player in a larger arena. The even more subtly diffracted moral chaos of full-service citizenship in a state. Except Schtitt says, ach, But who can imagine this training serving its purpose in an ex-imperialist and waste-exporting nation that's forgotten privation and hardship and the discipline which hardship teaches by requiring? A U.S. of modern A, where the state is not a team or a code, but a sort of sloppy intersection of desires and fears, where the only public consensus a boy must surrender to is the acknowledged primacy of straight-line pursuing this flat and short-sighted idea of personal happiness. The happy pleasure of the person alone, yes? Mario replies, except why do you think the Litton ties Pemulus and Shaw's shoes to the lines if the lines aren't boundaries? Without there is something bigger, nothing to contain and give the meaning. Lonely, Verstiegenheit. Bless you.
I want to give in and say, I mean, there is something definitely Melvillian in the incredible vividness of that language, the variety of the voices, shifting characters, and that's just one little, shall we say, little momentary tour de force in the writing.
Yeah. And it's on every page.
Let's give him the benefit of the doubt and all kinds of credit.
We'll take 8 out of 10.
We're speaking of the many parts that Boston played in David Foster Wallace's life and in his art. But his biographer, D.T. Max, reminds us furthermore of perhaps the most important claim for Boston, that it changed this precocious and troubled Midwestern child of academia. It made him a broader, even a better human being. His crucible years in Boston changed him.
By the time he gets to Boston, he's been an addict and he's, I think, 27 years old. He's beginning to look elsewhere for his wisdom. He's been unable to get out of his own head. There's a slogan in 12-step, you know, your best thinking got you here. And I think that's a slogan he took very much to heart. And as a result, you know, when he looked around for the characters he would create in Infinite Jest, I think he was very attracted to people who had less higher education, especially people in, you know, in his recovery group, the group called Crocodiles, you know, who are the sort of ordinary blue-collar workers who had been, you know, sober for 30 years. And, you know, he saw in them a wisdom that he very much wanted and didn't know how to get.
That was D.T. Max. His biography of David Foster Wallace is called Every Love Story is a Ghost Story. Our guest, Deb Larson, is one of those people who demonstrated that wisdom for David Foster Wallace. She went through her own treatment and recovery for bad alcoholism 31 years ago at the same halfway house, and she stayed on to this day as co-manager, what they called headmistress. Her name in Infinite Jest becomes Pat Muntisian. Here is how she is introduced through the eyes of young Mario, the same young Mario, who's a deformed but warm and innocent young man from the tennis academy up the hill. This is in Infinite Jest. Mario says, the headmistress has a disability and it had a wheelchair ramp installed and has twice invited Mario in during the day for a caffeine-free millennial fizzy. And Mario likes the place. It's crowded and noisy and none of the furniture has protective plastic wrap. But nobody notices anybody else or comments on a disability. And the headmistress is kind to the people, and the people cry in front of each other. The inside of it smells like an ashtray. But Mario's felt good both times in Ennett's house because it's very real. People are crying and making noise and getting less unhappy. And once he heard somebody say God with a straight face, and nobody looked at them or looked down or smiled in any sort of way where you could tell they were worried inside. Deb Larson, welcome. So here comes David Foster Wallace into Granada House in the late 1980s. A doctor at McLean Hospital has told him, stop drinking or you'll be dead within 2 years. And you're 5 years or so into recovery yourself. And David has confessed that he remembers feeling superior in that place, almost disdainful of the people he'd fallen among. I mean, do you remember the man arriving?
Chris, I can't say to you whether David was in the Granada House or not.
But we honor that. We honor that.
Okay.
Reservation. But Speak of him as a friend.
As a friend, he was the most extraordinary man, and he came from a different background, as you know, and an academic background, but he felt more at home with the people at Granada House.
How long did that take?
Not long at all. Not long at all. He had a friend who was an 18-year-old named Chris, and she was, she had AIDS when AIDS was a death sentence, and she was pregnant. And he loved her, and he listened to her, and he was her true friend. And when most people were afraid of her diagnosis and afraid of her imminent death, David was a different kind of person. The people we see at Granada House are, to many people, throwaway people. Their families have turned their backs on them because they can't take it anymore. They often have PTSD and traumatic brain injury and a whole host of disabilities. And that only made David love them more. He felt more comfortable with them than he did with many of the academics that he worked with.
What do you think happened to David Foster Wallace at Granada House? I mean, I mean it as a serious question. This is a hyper-competitive guy, an athlete, maniacally competitive when it came to writing and academic accomplishment. And he could also be a nasty sort of street guy, too, taking advantage of people in bars, including the fair sex. Something happened.
Well,
maybe it was you, too, Deb Larson.
I wouldn't say that. I would say it was Granada House. He felt comfortable with the honesty and the humanity and the... he loved to talk to the man with no hands as he smoked cigarettes. He never felt superior.
Go ahead. No, I was going to say, he was in a kind of agony himself of sleeplessness and doubt, and, you know, took him months to learn the meaning of one day at a time.
Well, but so are many of our residents. Maybe that's what made him feel comfortable at Granada House. There were broken people just like David was. And he felt at home.
In the book, the Pat Montesian character, based on you, co-ran the house with the man called Don Gately, a one-time Demerol addict and housebreaker and a militant sort of AA kind of guy to the end of his life, the end of the book. Did he change David Foster Wallace?
He was, if David was at Granada House, there was the Don Gately character was a real person, and he was a friend of David's. And
how did that work? What did you observe?
It was the most unusual pairing of individuals.
Gately in the novel is huge. I mean, he, Haystack Calhoun sort of guy.
Yes, he was huge. And dipped his toe into the criminal world and had done some housebreaking, but he was changed. And David and him became very close. And there was another character, friend of David's and Mary's.
That's Mary Carr,
yeah.
The poet and Liars Club memoirist, marvelous lady. Go ahead.
Right. His name was Mark, and he was also a friend of David's. And he was a cage boxer and a cage fighter, but with David and Mary as friends, he would go to poetry readings and at Harvard with the Don Gately character.
Stand by, Deb. For sure, however it happened, Granada House marked a giant turn in DFW's thinking and also his understanding of art. I mean, this goes pretty deep. Listen here. This briefly was David Foster Wallace in an interview with Michael Silverblatt of KCRW in Los Angeles in 1996, 2 years before he took his own life.
I don't think I really understood what loneliness was when I was a young man. And now I've got a much less clear idea of what the point of art is, but I think it's got something to do with loneliness and something to do with setting up a conversation between human beings. And I know that when I started this book, I had very vague and not very ambitious ambitions. And one was I wanted to do something really sad. I'd done comedy before. I wanted to do something really sad, and I wanted to do something about what was sad about America.
That was David Foster Wallace himself in a radio interview 2 years before he died. Bill Lattanzi, jump in here on what transforms a character.
Well, I think it goes back to what we were saying earlier about this search for a way out of solipsism, a way out of loneliness, a way out of self-involvement. And I wasn't there, but from what I've read and what I sense from the book, I think he found community at Granada House for the first time, a real connection, a real honest emotional connection with people. And I think that that was saving for him. And I think that if you look at the work from there forward through Pale King, community is what it's about. And I think he discovered it in those meetings. I don't think he considered himself superior. I think what was hard for him to understand was that his intellectualism wasn't everything. So in the book, he says one of the things you learn at Granada House is that just because something is logically correct doesn't mean it's true. Being smart doesn't help you live.
Deb Larson, do you want to add to that?
I think that recovery is a gift, and it's all about community, and whether it's AA or Granada House or Granada House. I agree with Bill. I think that David found it at Granada House, community and love and family.
I want to just throw this out. As I've been reading Wallace, I've been listening to John Coltrane, and it seems to me there's a correspondence there somewhere, that David Foster Wallace is kind of the Amherst version of Coltrane, the big themes being the addictive personality, B, the very sweet and gentle exterior, which you describe in Bill. John Coltrane, you know, he's associated with angry music, furious, you know, endlessly raging music, and yet he was always described, not just by musicians, but as an extraordinarily pleasant guy and sweet, quiet, gentle man. But third, this absolutely unstoppable drive to transform his suffering and his addiction into beauty. I mean, real beauty. How can we generalize here?
I think it's a wonderful comparison. You know, there's a wonderful Coltrane quote where he says, "I just want to be a force for good, real good." And it's always amazed me that...
And the late works, like, oh, not terribly late, but Precious Lord and Love Supreme, coming back to absolutely the oldest fundamentals we know.
You hear in that music, I think it's similar to what you get from Wallace, which is this really strong voice coming through to you that sounds like it's for you alone. You somehow understand exactly what he's feeling. I don't know how that happens when it's just sounds coming out of a horn, and I don't know really how it happens when it's just 1,000 pages of a book, but it happens. It's a kind of, Wallace described literature as a kind of magic, that you could jump over the self to the other through the books.
Hmm. We talked about the attractions of this book and whether or why it's the novel of a generation, but I wonder what it says, what it means about us readers today, all kinds of readers, who see themselves in this dilemma, and they want to embrace the Coltrane or specifically the Wallace resolution of all this tension in this bleak book and this bleak world.
Yeah, it's it's what we're looking for, and we never quite get there. I mean, for Wallace, he even says in this piece about irony that he may be trapped, but maybe the next generation of rebels will be the ones to get there.
Can I ask Deb, you know, he wrote that he did this under a death sentence, that it was either get into recovery or you're dead in 2 years. That concentrates the mind, and maybe that propels you, you know, willy-nilly toward community. Are there other ways to get there?
You mean from... No. When I went through Granada House, I was also given no chance of living. All of our residents have really, they're fighting for their lives. And so was David. But we find joy in the journey, and we find each other, and it's a miracle.
Keep doing it. Thank you, Deb Larson. Thank you, Bill Latunzi. Thanks to Sven Burkitz and DT Max. This has been infinite fun, and we'll keep thinking about it. Our closing music comes not from John Coltrane, but from Brian Eno. When David Foster Wallace was living on Houghton Street in Somerville, eating Pop-Tarts, smoking cigarettes, worried about his writing, he'd be listening to this song on repeat, ever the obsessive that he was. The song is The Big Ship. Thanks also to Bill Buettler. Check out his terrific website, Infinite Boston, featuring a Google Maps atlas of all the places mentioned in the book. You can find a link on our website, along with an extended podcast of our Infinite Boston tour with Bill Latanzi. There are also longer conversations with Sven Burkitz and David Foster Wallace's biographer, D.T. Max. You'll find other links to David Foster Wallace World and wide open space for comments and a lively conversation going forward. I will be in it with you at radioopensource.org. There are other features there, too. We're still reading Chekhov. We're thinking about the sublime music and brain connections in conversation with the novelist Richard Powers. We're hard at work on next week's program with the Why Nations Fail economist at MIT, Daron Acemoglu. Tell us where this economy is pinching you. We had lots of help this week from our infinitely talented crew, George Hicks at the radio controls, and our amazing production team of Kunal Jasti and Max Larkin, led by the incomparable executive producer Mary McGrath. Finally, we're grateful for the infinite wisdom of our good friend and advisor, Mike Zack. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next week on Open Source.